I can help it.
So, war is rolling on. That's what happens. Take a class on war that technically lasts 30 years.
The end game is in sight. We only have a few more weeks, and we gotta get to the point where we left off. Right? When I shut the door in Dill's face. Oh, and she closes it with authority.
Slammed it.
I mean, just like insane, yo. Alright. That's where I left off. Alright, so we know that 1965 was a significant year of escalation. We know that the United States started engaging in its first significant pitched battles with the enemy. We know that this was occurring because of Westmoreland's strategy of Americanizing the war. We also saw the impact of the arrival of the American soldiers and the new tactics that were implemented to deal with the terrain of Vietnam, particularly the air cavalry. The use of Huey helicopters, the use of pounding airstrikes to clear a landing zone, to fly the troops in, to deploy the troops out of the helicopter, to secure the LZ, and then continue to bring in more and more and more to the point where you can stage operations. Of course, we saw that that also could result in casualties. And the big example that we looked at was really the biggest battle of 1965, the Battle of Ia Drang, which of course was memorialized in When We Were Soldiers, which Mel Gibson stars in. And again, you want to see a good representation of what men like my father had to deal with in country, watch that movie. I think it's on Prime. Well, I don't know. It might be on Hulu or it might be on Netflix at this point because they all bounce around. But When We Were Soldiers, good, good flick. But basically, the truth of the matter is, it's not like they were going and taking over territory. They were flying soldiers into the jungle. They were killing a few hundred VC. Then they were getting on the helicopters and they were flying out. Ultimately, the war was becoming stalemated. But on paper, it seemed like it was going well. U.S. Marines, U.S. soldiers in the army could pretty much go anywhere in South Vietnam. And they engaged in seemingly constant clashes, resulting in seeming, I don't want to say victories, but they definitely weren't losses. And unlike any other war to date, there were reporters embedded in their units, and they were reporting back to the United States. And for the most part, the stories were mostly positive. And the media wasn't playing the games that they played with Trump. The media was pro-America, supportive of the war. Of course, they meant that even if there was bad news, they suppressed it. They tried showing positive symbols of American soldiers fighting to save freedom. Of course, in doing so, what America was really doing was propping up Saigon. The government in Saigon was basically saved from collapse. So that created a weird irony. American boys are shedding American blood, and we're spilling American treasure. so that way the South Vietnamese boys can stay at home and the South Vietnamese treasure can stay in Saigon's bank accounts. But in a poll that was taken in 1965, two-thirds of Americans approved of the way LBJ was handling the war. And LBJ had a 64% approval rating. FYI, Trump is just below 50. And Biden was never higher than 40%. Generally speaking, America has been divided so long. The best, I think Obama had a few years in the when he was like in his first term where he might have got over 50. But the fact that LBJ in the midst of this war had 64%, honest to God, I think the last president to be that high was Reagan. So, if the news is putting positive spin, Americans have hope, the president's popular, he can continue to pursue the policies that he wants. But outward appearances can be deceiving. While LBJ and all of the administration was putting a positive spin on everything, what he was getting in terms of actual intelligence was actually sobering. The war was not going as well as it appeared on CBS or NBC or ABC. First, the Joint Chiefs of Staff recommended increasing Westmoreland's 44 battalion request by adding an additional 113,000 soldiers in country. Plus, they wanted to start launching B-52s to bomb North Vietnam. And they wanted to start mining North Vietnamese ports, possibly using U.S. submarines. But at the same time, the Joint Chiefs Chairman, General Earl Boss Wheeler, told the president, unless we unleash our full capacity, so our full air strength, our full naval strength, our full ground strength, this war is just going to continue with slow drips. And it's going to go on and on and on. So, instead of playing patty cakes, what Wheeler is saying is pulverize them. But then, LBJ receives an even gloomier report, scarier report. As I mentioned, after the Battle of Y Trung, McNamara got on the phone and had an extended conversation with Colonel Moore. After that conversation of how the Vietnamese fought and what happened out there, the fact that the Vietnamese had these tunnels buried into mountains and they came out of nowhere and they used human wave attacks. For the first time in a report that reached the president's desk in December of 1965, McNamara admitted that even with increased strength, even if we maximize our attacks, this war is going to be at best stalemated for another 2 or 3 years. So even if we do shock and awe, the body bags, the flag draped coffins are only going to increase. And again, what's going to happen to the opinions of the American people then? So, for the first time, he actually suggested, should we try diplomacy? Should we send signals to Hanoi that maybe we might be willing to sit down and have a conversation? McNamara urged LBJ to pause Operation Torchlight, the massive bombing campaign. Why? Well, if you send feelers through diplomatic channels and you stop bombing them, Hanoi is going to understand that something's up. And they may pull back some of their regular troops, which might result in a de-escalation. Well, then, apparently, according to the recordings, because I told you before, LBJ recorded all the conversations, LBJ replied to this, then, no matter what we do in the military field, there is no sure victory. And McNamara responded equally bluntly. That's right. We have been too optimistic. We've gotten it wrong. There is no win. That conversation happened in December 1965. But if you recall from the first class, the last boots left Vietnam in 1973. There's still 8 more years of war. On December 27th, after his conversations with McNamara, he ordered a pause in bombing of North Vietnamese targets. But he is on record as basically saying, yeah, I don't know if this is really going to make a difference. He personally believed, and as he responded to McNamara, he was inclined to support General Wheeler's assessment. The only way to get Hanoi to the table is make them realize the futility of it. To basically grind them down so they become desperate. But he heeded the advice of his advisors. Then the very next day, he launched what he called the peace offensive. Envoys. Men close to the president unofficially traveled to the capitals of 115 governments. And they were ordered to explain the president's thinking. Any of you ever play games with your friends to kind of use them to get something you want out of them? I would hope so. It's a human thing to do. You manipulate the people. You don't come right out and tell them what you want. Subtle things like, oh, wow, wow. Actually, no one has food because I was going to try pinching some food off of some people. But wow, you know, doesn't, like the other day, you had those candies. They looked really good. What do you think you would have done if I started doing that to you? Oh, yeah, thank you. I could have played her. But I didn't, because I have too much respect for her. Well, LBJ was essentially hoping to play some government somewhere that would let Hanoi know. But unfortunately, there is no proof that Hanoi heard. So this brings us to January 1, 1966. And it was as the new year rolled around that the first cracks in the facade began to appear. First, this. Death. Casualties were mounting. Son of a biscuit, where's my numbers? Man, did I screw up all my PowerPoints? I intentionally put in the death count for 1965 in here. Think, Lemanic, think. All right, if I got it right, if I remember correctly, 1965, and you can correct me, this data is available online. I just skipped over it. Here we go. Duh. I had it underlined. 1965 saw a total of 1,928 deaths. Now, FYI, when the United States first arrived, technically, in 1956, all the way through 1964, there had only been 411 U.S. deaths. So this number of 1928 is what? 5 times larger than the total deaths up to this point. But what makes it scary is when you break down the numbers. 2/3 were killed in action. The other third, some died of their wounds, so they were pulled off the battlefield, but they died in hospital. Some died in accidents. You have 19, 20-year-old guys with guns and tanks and planes. People get hurt. But in 1965, there were 3 reported suicides. Soldiers refusing to go and fight shot themselves instead of going out into the jungle. 3. Also, appearing on college campuses, protests started appearing. Students were fearful of the draft, and they were angry with the escalation of the war. They were angry with what President Lyndon Baines Johnson was doing. And by the way, it's very normal, because the youth never experienced real life, and those are the ones most likely to be activists and go out to protest for the sake of protesting. But when you actually look at who was organizing the protest, even today, it's not the fact that you hear those knuckleheads are doing the pro-Palestinian protests. It's not the kids that get sucked into it. It's who's organizing it. Who's paying for it? Who are the leaders? Well, on more and more campuses, a radical, socialist, anti-establishment group known as the Students for a Democratic Society, the SDS, began appearing on campuses across the country. They called for anarchy. They called for socialism, redistribution of wealth. They called for social justice. But they also called for the president to end the Cold War and embrace the communist nations as equals. So this group started organizing campus-based anti-war protests, and It was only a matter of time before the protests on the campuses bled out onto the streets. For example, on April 15th, 1965, the SDS protested what was known as the Women's Strike for Peace. This would be a march in Washington, D.C., and over 25,000 people protested, mostly college kids, mostly girls. The SDS also began organizing those things that would become synonymous with the protests in the late 60s. The sit-ins and the teach-ins and the occupation of buildings. And why was it the college kids?
Well, they don't have jobs. College kids have no responsibilities. They can come to class whenever they want. They don't have to pay attention. It doesn't matter. They get time to go and protest.
But the moment the young people started engaging in shenanigans, it started appearing in newspapers. It started appearing on TV. So at the same time, the press is saying, the war is going well, they also start reporting, yeah, but there are people upset about it. And when the stories start to twist, the politicians begin trying to get out in front of these movements. Interestingly enough, Congress, which was controlled overwhelmingly by the Democrats, the congressional leaders began expressing doubts. Are we really winning? What does victory look like? And can we achieve it? Well, fast forward to January 31st, 1965, and LBJ announces he's going to resume bombing because his little peace offensive amounted to nothing. Well, the day that the president announces that the bombing is going to continue, none other than Senator from Massachusetts, Robert F. Kennedy, does what Cory Booker did on Monday. He takes to the Senate floor and he declares, if we regard bombing as the answer in Vietnam, we are headed straight for disaster. Bobby Kennedy is the first congressional Democrat to send a message to the people of the United States. All is not what it seems. Following that speech, he then announces to the press that he has formulated a peace plan. He has mapped out a way for the South Vietnamese government to remain in place, but he wants to work with the VC to form a coalition of government. In other words, allow the NLF, the National Liberation Front, form a political party and let them run candidates in elections. Well, at his press conference, reporters asked you, Senator, are you speaking on behalf of the President of the United States? And he replied, and I quote, I don't think that anyone has ever suggested that I was speaking for the White House. This was a fire shot across the bow. Because in 1966, Senator Kennedy was contemplating a run for the White House in 1968. Just like Senator Cory Booker is doing now. as if that was not bad enough for the president? Chairman of the powerful Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator William Fulbright, Democrat of Arkansas, begins televised hearings on the progress in Vietnam. For those of you disinterested in politics, the Senate and the House, what's going on in Congress, you can watch it now in TV, on TV. The C-SPAN channels. So if you ever become interested in what our government's doing, you literally have the ability to watch it from the comforts of your home. Well, prior to 1966, it was very rare that a congressional hearing was televised because very few people actually had TVs. But yet, Senator Fulbright chairs this committee, and he allowed the press to come in, and they covered from gavel to gavel a debate by leaders in Congress over the war in Vietnam. During the hearing, Senator Fulbright actually says he's suspicious. He's not only suspicious of the flow of information that the White House is sharing with Congress, but he's also suspicious of the ambitions of those involved with the executive branch. He also states, rhetorically, wondering aloud, if the reporters who are reporting the information that comes from the White House, are they actually reporting the truth? Or is it what we would call today fake news? And then finally, Fulbright raises issues with the level of presidential war powers going back to the Gulf of Tonkin Declaration. He wonders if the president got that declaration truthfully, or was the Gulf of Tonkin incident a fabrication? FYI, Democrats would do this to George W. Bush shortly after American soldiers were deployed not only to Afghanistan, but also Iraq. And when the Democrats began doing that, just like what's going on in Vietnam here, popular approval in the United States of not only George Bush, but also what our soldiers are doing in the global war on terrorism began to shift. Well, now, for the first time, you got kids protesting, you got body bags coming home, and you got members of the president's own party kind of asking, what's going on? Questions? Well, LBJ, being the political mastermind that he was, quickly did an assessment. All right. Do I got to worry about leaks? No, not really. Do I got to worry about the Joint Chiefs? No, not really. Do I got to worry about the Democrats in Congress? Not really. But he knew if he lost the support of the people, he would lose. So, he came up with a scheme. He began dropping comments to his buddies in the press, essentially saying
that if anyone is criticizing what we're doing, they're being duped by communist propaganda.
Ah, when in doubt, pull out the commie card.
Geez, I can't wait to see how you do on the final exam when you can't use your computer or your notes.
He was prepared to use his influence over the media to spin the story, to keep the support of the American people.
Have any of you ever studied any Roman history? How did the Roman emperors keep control of the people in Rome? Do you know what they used? There was a tactic. No. It was called bread and circus. So what the Roman emperors would do is they gave out free bread to the people, because you want to get a bunch of people hangry, let the population of one of the largest cities on earth start starving. Then you have to deal with the mob. So what do? You give them free food. And then you entertain them. Gladiatorial games. LBJ realized the best way to keep the people from getting concerned is to keep them fat and stupid. So at the same time, he's trying to figure out how to push the advantage in Vietnam. 1966 is when he starts declaring his war on poverty. He also engages Martin Luther King Jr. He engages Malcolm X and other civil rights leaders. He's telling the American people, look at how good I am. Because he's trying to distract them from what's going on. And then he came up with a brilliant move. Let's hold a counter event to counter what Senator Fulbright's doing. He declares that he is going to travel to Honolulu in Hawaii and meet with the government of South Vietnam for 3 days on camera meetings between the President of the United States and the then Prime Minister of South Vietnam, Nguyen Cao Ky. They sat side by side, they yucked it up, they told jokes, and they constantly talked about how the two are the closest friends.
Of course, FYI, we haven't really been talking about South Vietnamese politics like we had before, because we gotta get through the war, but Nguyen Cao Ky and two of his fellow generals launched a coup and seized power 3 months before. So don't think that politics have stabilized in South Vietnam. You still have generals that are cooing other generals who are cooing other generals,
all vying for control. This is just the latest comer.
And everything is nice, because of course before the stories come on, they show like hula girls and the guys walking around with leis and they're laughing and smiling. Good images to counter the Fulbright hearings, which are boring. Who wants to sit there and watch congressional leaders talk about things? No, let's look at these guys getting along in Hawaii, dreaming of the beaches of Honolulu.
Well,
when the three-day event concludes,
President LBJ, I mean, look at them.
Look at how happy they are. They also have leaders from Japan. I think this is the leader from the Philippines.
You know, all of Asia is joined together as one. Well, they would make a declaration known as the Declaration of Honolulu. This declaration contained LBJ's desires for social reform in America. Let's have more democracy. Let's fight a war against poverty. Let's engage in civil rights. Well, Nguyen Cao Ky, he promised to do the same in South Vietnam once the war is over.
Sounds great.
Bread and circus. But what was not aired on public were the details of this document. And one of the last name lines basically was a pledge that both would continue to wage war against communism until communism was eradicated in South Vietnam.
What's the big deal? If you don't eradicate communism, like you promise you're going to eradicate communism, you look like a loser.
Questions?
Well, when the cameras weren't rolling, the Honolulu conference also gave an opportunity for General Westmoreland, who flew out of country and met the president in Honolulu, to sit down with LBJ and his advisors and to basically map out the strategies for 1966. Westmoreland's goals were simple. He wanted to increase the kill ratio to a level equal to the VC and the NVA's ability to put men in the field. In other words, for every one new VC man, there would be one death. He also promised to decrease the areas where the VC were operating from 90% in the rural countryside down to 40%. He was going to kill more of them by taking the war to them.
Well, of course, these two goals are batshit crazy. How many men of your own do you have to send into the field to have a kill ratio equal to, for every one man up, there's one man down? And how do you prove that? How do you quantify that? And then two, we've been talking about the terrain of Vietnam. It's rainforest. Talk to anyone. If you know any Vietnam veteran, talk to them what it was like in Vietnam. My father was there for two tours. He was there early, late 67, all the way through mid 69. He doesn't talk about the war because he actually was a combat soldier. And real combat soldiers don't brag. But every now and then, when he's grumbling, when the weather looks like crap, like it does today, when I remember him, little one-liners would come out. Well, at least it didn't rain for 6 months. Vietnam is nasty. It's not a fun place to be. So how are you not only going to deploy enough men to kill one-to-one, but how are you going to deploy enough men that you're going to shrink
their areas of movement by 40% in remote jungles.
Impossible.
Westmoreland also told the president he was going to focus primarily by securing three primary areas of operation. Up here is the city of Hue, which we haven't talked about in a while. H-U-E, Hue. If you remember, this is the ancient capital back when Vietnam had kings. This is also the biggest city that's close to the DMZ. So Westmoreland basically said if he could cull this area of VC, this would serve as a buffer for the rest of Vietnam. He also talked about the lowlands that are on the coast. Tons and tons of miles of beaches, all woven in to little ports that you could sail in at night. Westmoreland knew that the VC were getting supplied by sea. But he believed if he could secure this region, again, cut off the bullets, cut off the guns. And lastly, he would attempt to secure a wide perimeter around Saigon. He knew that the enemy had constructed a whole bunch of bases and a vast tunnel network. So if he could stabilize the capital of Saigon, isolate the ancient capital, and protect the coastland, he's going to win. Well, of course, during the Honolulu conference, he gives a presentation to the press. And the press began asking him questions. General Westmoreland, how are you going to achieve these goals? Well, he made this famous comment. The nature of the enemy is such that we cannot expect him to be defeated by a single battle or series of battles. He will have to be ferreted out over a period of time, which would involve many campaigns and many operations. He basically admits. He admits. And it's reported. We're in this for the long haul. This is not going to be done easily, ladies and gentlemen. And of course, the longer the war goes on, the more body bags are going to come home. He then begged the president to give him the ability to take the war to the enemy. But LBJ said no. He wanted to use U.S. Special Forces and cross the DMZ and start attacking North Vietnam directly. The president said, no, we don't want to antagonize China. He then makes a note, how am I, Mr. President, going to defend about 800 miles of coastland? I need more men. The president said, you're going to have to make do with what you got. And then he says, Mr. President, I know about this thing called the Ho Chi Minh Trail that the Vietnamese have been using since the Indo-Chinese War. But the problem is it goes from North Vietnam into Laos and then into Cambodia before coming into South Vietnam. Mr. President, can I strike the Ho Chi Minh Trail?
To which LBJ said, no.
So if you cannot cut off the enemy's supply, if you cannot take the war to the enemy, how are you going to win? The result? Attrition. There was no other way around it.
The only choice, and I quote, was to seek out enemy units and inflict heavy casualties on them until Hanoi wakes up to the fact that they have been bled, or they have bled their country to the point of a national disaster for generations.
You just kill them all. Until there's no more one left to kill. Well, Westmoreland would conclude that we're not going to win this war of attrition. Instead, what it's only going to do is it's only going to weaken both sides. Yeah, are we going to do damage? Sure. But how are we going to know if it's winning? Well, the only measurable way to view this goal is through body counts.
So literally, you kill as many as you can, and then you do a head count. There's one dead, there's two dead, there's three dead.
But the problem is you know what the VC did? The VC would do everything they can to pull their dead and wounded off the battlefield. They very rarely, if ever, left corpses if they could do something about it. They also very rarely, if ever, left guns or ammunition or anything.
When the VC came in attack, they did everything they could to pull all they could out.
So if you have a battlefield and you manage to count 47 VC, did you actually kill 47? Or did you kill 97? Did you kill 147? Don't know. So if you're going to win by killing one to one, and you can't even count how many are dead, how can you prove you're winning? And at the end of the day, how many soldiers do they have? We had no relations with North Vietnam ever. We have no basis for censuses or headcount. For all we knew, they could have 50 million people. Or they might have 1 million. They may have an army of 75 million strong, or they might be 40,000. We don't know. You know, FYI, when we fought World War II, we knew roughly how many Germans there were, we knew roughly how many Italians there were, and we knew roughly how many Japanese there were.
We had sound data to suggest how big their militaries were. So we could do body counts there. We knew how much energy they had left.
But Vietnam, who freaking knows?
Plus, many of the NLF are South Vietnamese.
How many of those peasants are fighting this war? And by the way, how can you tell a VC from a non-VC? They didn't wear uniforms. Just like I was to scan you guys and gal. I would have no idea if any of you were terrorists. I have no idea. It's redundant. I said it three times. We just don't know. We just don't know. Oh, one thing I did not mention. You also have to factor in the amount of women and children
that was supporting the VC. I don't know if I have time, but I actually have a unit somewhere. I got to see if I can add it in. That talks about actual VC female units. And those VC women were more deadly than the men. Because you know what the VC women would do? They would act like what the U.S. boys would call hoochie-coochie mamas. They would pretend to be prostitutes. And what they would do is they would poison, or they would cut the throats of soldiers going to procure their services. Or they would be cleaning ladies that did the laundry on the bases, and they would smuggle in explosives. The enemy was everywhere. So how are you going to do one-to-one? And at the end of the day, the truth of the matter is, the United States military machine assembled by Westmoreland was not suited for the type of war that needed to be fought in Vietnam. Yes, we had battalions. Yes, we had air power. We had artillery. We had naval power. We had elaborate logistics and electronic surveillance and communication apparatus. But to win, we had to find, fix, fight, and finish the enemy. Finding them was hard enough. But pinning them down long enough to finish them was impossible. Why? The enemy was fluid, like water. But they would try. And this is how they would fight. It's a military video. It covers an operation, military operation called Operation Moby, which commenced on April 11th, 1966. Oh, there we go. Again, this is not a press video. This is a military video. Recorded and published by the United States Armed Forces. Come on.
At a staging area in the central highlands near Pleiku, a ground control officer coordinates the loading of UH-1D helicopters as units of the 1st Cavalry Division prepare to jump off on a search and destroy mission against the Viet Cong. The assault choppers lift the air cavalrymen to landing zones Kim and Amy from 70 kilometers northwest of Pleiku and about 100 meters from the Cambodian border. It is 11 April, and the first phase of Operation Mosby is beginning. At landing zone Kim, the immediate mission of the first wave of troops is to secure the area for subsequent sorties. While a perimeter defense is being set up, mortar crews lay their weapons. A smoke grenade is used to signal the second wave of cavalrymen that landing zone Kim has been secured and that it is safe to land. Units have drawn no enemy fire, and as the troops hit the ground, they move rapidly to the perimeter of the LZ, leaving the center free for helicopter traffic. These troops will hold the LZ for the next few days so that other units probing the jungles around it will have a secure base upon which to rely for quick support. The overall mission of this battalion-sized operation is to set up ambushes near the Cambodian border and to disrupt the suspected VC buildup of men and materiel in the area. The patrols, however, were routine. Other than the difficult terrain, One of the greatest challenges was to locate an adequate supply of usable water. There was no contact with the enemy by the element film, and after 3 days of fruitless probe, the units gave up the search and pulled back to Doctor Dry River, where they began clearing a sandbar for a three-ship landing zone. As the Huey touched down, the cavalrymen rushed aboard and will soon be making their second assault landing within 4 days. From this pickup point in Tongsun Province, the units are evacuated to landing zone Jones, which they will secure to support battalion forward operations in the new area. As the first phase of Operation Mosby nears its end, there has been little contact with the enemy, but a considerable amount of BC equipment and ammunition was captured. After the new LZ is secure, the units are resupplied before continuing their patrol. Several days later, on 21 April, other units of the 1st Cavalry Division move out of their base camp at Ontay to begin the second phase of Operation Mosby. This part of the campaign is directed against an area in Pleiku Province, some 25 kilometers northeast of the town of Pleiku, in a region where U.S. forces have never before operated. After landing zones are secured, Chinook helicopters begin shoveling in rations, ammunition, and other equipment to keep the using units resupplied. At one of the forward LZs, artillery crews quickly lay their lightweight M-102 howitzers and begin firing a mission in support of an infantry unit that is pushing 2,000 meters to the north. Meanwhile, the commander of the brigade-sized force discusses the situation with subordinate commanders and his S2. On the following day, 22 April, a captured BC suspect is brought to a forward CP. The prisoner is fed and then turned over to a Vietnamese intelligence officer for interrogation. After detailed questioning, the captive points out on the map an area where Viet Cong might be holed up. Suspect is bound, and plans are made for an attack against the suspected BC stronghold. With the bound prisoner in tow, a company moves out to investigate the information. Early in the march, a grass hut containing about 1,000 pounds of rice is located, but there is no sign of the Viet Cong. The hut is burned to the ground, and the company continues its search of the area. Soon after, the company comes upon a village that appears to be abandoned. The unit holds up at the edge of the jungle while the CO deploys his platoons around the cluster of that hut. Houses are far from deserted, and all the villagers are soon assembled for questioning. Although the inhabitants deny any involvement with the BC, there is disconcerting evidence to the contrary. A clump of bamboo spikes is found, such as those used by the BC for fungi space. Also, there is a suspicious number of able-bodied adult males present. After much questioning through an interpreter with negative results, the suspected guerrillas are called out and then marched away. They will be airlifted to a battalion CP for interrogation by a Vietnamese intelligence officer. Then the company leaves the village to continue its search of the area. At a battalion CP the following day, 24 April, the commander of the unit participating in phase two of Operation Mosby arrives for a report on latest developments. This extensive four-day search of an area 20 by 30 kilometers square has produced no significant contact with the enemy.
Operation after operation after operation. FYI, in World War I and World War II, the typical American soldier in a calendar year spent at most 40 days in combat. In Vietnam, a typical soldier on a one-year tour, because of operations like that, 240 days out of a year. You would be flown in, you would walk around the jungle for a couple of days, then you would get on a helicopter, then you would be airlifted to another location and walk around the jungle for another few days, then get put on a helicopter, be airlifted to another location in the jungle and walk around for another few days. Over and over and over again. Problem was, as was highlighted toward the end, when they got into a Vietnamese village, who's the enemy? Who's not? Well, a lot of diaries of Vietnam War veterans describe the enemy as being like water, very fluid. There were many large enemy units that operated near the DMZ, the Demilitarized Zone, but just on the North Vietnamese side, because American war restrictions didn't allow American soldiers to go and get them. So that would be like us sitting here and looking where the parking lot is over down there behind where the dorm is, pretty far away over there, and we could see the enemy over there, but we can't do anything about it. To make matters worse, we also knew that there were large units operating in Laos, in Cambodia. They knew about the Ho Chi Minh Trail, but we can't go get them. So, whenever the American units would fly out into the jungles where the VC were operating, all the VC did was simply go over to the border. Because look at me, you can't touch me here. And the Vietnamese had, well, the Viet Cong had units everywhere in South Vietnam. There were spies all over the place. They knew when the helicopters were taking off at the bases. They had agents inside. They get access to the data, the maps, the plans. And it was all being reported. So, out in play cool, why didn't, when the unit first touched down, they come in contact with any enemy in 3 days? Well, probably because they had already bugged out. And plus, let's be honest, if you're in a jungle, have any of you ever seen a Huey helicopter? I know there's not really many flying around anymore, but they're loud. You can't miss them when they're coming. So if you're the VC and you see the helicopters fly overhead, and you're like, there seems to be a lot of them. We're not going to fight today. Or they'd go into their tunnels. And they literally would be under the feet of the American soldiers. Now, last click of the day. What about Westmoreland's plan of attrition? One for one. Did these operations actually accomplish anything? Well, yeah. We showed that American forces had the tactical ability to reach the enemy wherever they were. We definitely disrupted some of their larger bases. We definitely drove the enemy away from population centers. And yes, the casualty rate on the enemy side was high. But the problem is, you fly into a location, you find a couple of VC, you take them out, what are you going to do when you're done? You're not staying there. You're not occupying the land. You're getting on a helicopter, and you're flying back to the base or to another location. Compare that to how we fought in World War II.
marched across North Africa, invaded Italy, landed in Normandy, raced through France and into Germany. We attacked the enemy, we pursued the enemy, and we took the land. In the Pacific, the island hopping campaign, slowly moving through the Pacific, island by island, getting closer to Japan. But in Vietnam, we'd go out, get back on the helicopter, and go away. So what do you think the VC did? Here comes the Americans. Let's hide. Oh, the Americans are gone. We're back again. It was the wrong war. Or it might have been the right war. I don't know. But it definitely was fought the wrong way. Questions? We're going to come back on Tuesday. We're going to finish the last chunk of information for exam number 3. Exam number 3 will be your last exam that's on Engage. Those of you who got tagged after the second exam, don't repeat. Then the final exam will be a paper exam here in class in person. No notes. So you better start taking good notes. Stop watching your videos after the third exam. And then you better study. Final exam is worth 35% of your grade. Your paper, which is due on April 22nd, is worth 20% of your grade. Your paper, as I will remind you, is not about your proficiency as writing English. I'm not an English professor. I'm not going to grade it like an English paper. I'm going to grade it based on directions. And the directions are on proflematic.com. If you've had me before, you know what I'm talking about. If not, go on my website and look it up. Because it is possible to get a negative grade if you don't follow the directions and you incur so many penalties. So don't be like the person I had last semester that it got a negative 18. Have a good weekend.